Well, the Exodus from Egypt is one of the foundational events of the Bible. We think about the Ten Commandments, and this is the place where, for the first time, in clear, explicit words, the Ten Commandments were spelled out.
Thank you. I'd like to give thanks to my
nephew-in-law, Ed Christian,
who's been the slide technician throughout the entire week, and I think you should give him a hand of applause for his good work. If it weren't for him, you would see nothing. Nothing. Well, the Israelites started in Egypt. They dwelt there a long time. Exodus 12:40, a literal surface reading, says 430 years. And that's a long time. And so Jacob goes down to Egypt at the end of the book of Genesis with 70 members in his extended family. And the Israelites come out of Egypt with a great nation. And in between, they lived under Egyptian control. And at the first, that Egyptian control was very favorable and very kindly because of the great work that Joseph had done on behalf of the Egyptians. And, of course, as a byproduct of serving the Egyptians, he was able to serve and save his own family. And so as we think about these important events of the Exodus, let's pray as we take our journey into the Bible lands. Loving Heavenly Father, we thank you for the way you led your people in the past. We thank you for the wonderful law that you gave them in your great mercy. We thank you for the direct way in which you manifested your power and your presence with them. And we ask that this encourage each one here today to know that God can do it again in each of our churches and in each of our lives. So be our instructor this afternoon, I ask in Jesus' name. Amen. So we find the Israelites ground down in slavery towards the latter end of their stay in Egypt. Basically, the slavery in Egypt probably fluctuated, but the real point is it got worse towards the end. And the probable reason why it got worse was because there was a change of rulership in Egypt. For about two centuries, the country had been ruled by foreigners, the northern half of the country. And we call those people Hyksos. That's the Egyptian name, a condensed form of the Egyptian name for these people. Basically, the Egyptian word means ruler of foreign countries. Josephus got it wrong when he translated this as shepherd kings. Ruler of foreign countries. These people were probably from Syria and Canaan, and we probably would classify them biblically as Amorites. Amorites. These were rather warlike people. The Amorites invaded Babylon to the east, and they invaded Canaan to the south, and finally they invaded Egypt. They started in northeastern Syria. That was their homeland. And so these Amorites, or Hyksos, came to control Egypt, the northern half of it. They never conquered the southern half. The southern half was always the homeland of the native Egyptians. And they were not conquered down there. And each time Egypt revived from a foreign invasion or a division, the stimulus to unite the country was always from the south. And so the 18th dynasty, which starts around Thebes or Karnak in the south, marched north, defeated the Hyksos, kicked them out of the country, and now the rulership over the Israelites changes hands. And the record says that these people built storehouses for Pharaoh. And that was part of the slavery, and that was part of their brickmaking task. Now, what is a store city? At this time, the 18th dynasty went on the road of conquest. They marched into Asia. In fact, one of their pharaohs marched 20 different campaigns into Asia. Now, you need storehouses for two reasons. You need a quartermaster depot to supply your own troops with weapons and food and other materiel. And so the store cities served to provision and equip the outgoing army. But now as the army goes out, the army makes its conquests and brings back the booty, the tribute, the tax, which has been confiscated from foreign countries that they have conquered. And so as you bring this material back to Egypt, you deposit that in the storehouses. So the storehouses had a dual purpose, to supply the outgoing army and to bring back the goods of the Near East as the army returned to Egypt. So the Israelites had to build buildings. And they had to build those buildings with mud bricks. There's more limestone block in Palestine. There's more trees up in Syria. But in Egypt, it's the gift of the Nile. Even the clay is the gift of the Nile. And so here you see an Egyptian workman making mud bricks today. And you can see how they do it. These are sun-dried bricks. I've mentioned, I think, once before that there are two kinds of bricks. There are sun-dried bricks like these, and there are kiln-fired bricks where you put them on a pallet and put them into the kiln and you fire them. And the kiln-fired bricks are harder. So bricks like these would be used in the inner part of a building, and the kiln-fired bricks would be used on the hard outer surface. And so this is what the Israelites were engaged in. They probably also had to engage in other enterprises in Egypt. And here's an Egyptian painting from about 1200 BC of a carpenter at work. And there's another carpenter up above, but his picture has been broken away. And this man is working with an adze, and he's carving some of the timbers. Looks like it's probably a ship or maybe a house or something like that he's building on. And it would not be surprising to have found some of the Israelites in Egypt working on this type of construction also, nicely illustrated for us by our Egyptian artist. This is another type of occupation, and maybe there would have been less Israelites in this, but these two men in the center of the picture are catching birds out in the swamp of the Delta. And so they have bird catching equipment, and they have a bird in the, or two in the net, and they are bringing the birds and I guess fish also. It looks like there's a fish down below. So both fishing and bird catching were common activities of the Egyptians in the swamps of the Delta. And here's a tomb relief. You see, the Egyptian idea of the afterlife is you're supplied with everything that's good in this life, only more so. And so on the walls of their tombs, they showed all of these activities in which the Egyptians engaged during their lifetime. And the idea is this is a token of what is then going to happen to them in the afterlife. This is an Egyptian, it's called a pectoral. It's a jeweled ornament which is worn over the chest or around the neck. And you can see the precious stones. The red stones are carnelian. There's some turquoise there. There's some lapis lazuli. And so these, you can also see not only the fact that there are precious stones involved here, but you can also see the fact that this is very, very fine workmanship. This belonged to a princess of the 12th dynasty who lived about 1800 BC. That would be approximately the time of Joseph. And the Egyptians went out to the mines in Sinai, and some of the turquoise that went into these ornaments came from the mines in Sinai. We're going to look at those mines out there because they bear indirectly upon the Exodus. Now, the question then is, who was the Pharaoh of the Exodus? Well, here he is. His name is Thutmose III. And he was a great empire builder, probably the greatest empire builder Egypt ever saw. And this illustrates something about the time of the Exodus. God did not take his people out of the country at a time of weakness and obscurity. He took his people out of the country at the time when there was a very, very strong dynasty on the throne. And he took his people out of the country at the time when there was, if anything, the strongest ruler of that dynasty on the throne. Now, how do we know he's the ruler of the Exodus, the Pharaoh of the Exodus? Well, the evidence is indirect. He didn't leave behind us any inscription which says, you know, so many thousand Israelites left my country in such and such a year of my reign. He doesn't say that. In fact, no Egyptian pharaoh would, regardless of when the Exodus took place. And the reason for that is this. The pharaohs were gods. In Egypt, they actually believed that the pharaoh was a god incarnate. He was the Horus god. And the Horus god is represented by a hawk. And so they could not admit that this god, who is in charge of Egypt, that anything bad could ever happen to the land during the time that this god supervised the land. Now, there's an interesting aspect to this, and that is the Egyptians never admitted that any pharaoh ever died. Never admitted they died. Well, wait a minute, they did die. We know there's all these mummies in the mummy room, right? So how did they get around that? How did they handle that problem? They would say something like this. This king ruled 54 years to a ripe old age, and then he went back to the sun god who begat him. It's as if he sailed up to heaven and rejoined the sun god. They wouldn't admit that his earthly body died, but they said he just went back to the sun god. Now, the interesting thing is, occasionally, just occasionally, we will get the death date as to when he is supposed to have gone back to rejoin the sun god. Now, the Egyptian calendar is really a very even calendar. Our calendar today is a direct descendant of the Egyptian calendar, not the Jewish calendar, not the Babylonian calendar. It's the Egyptian calendar, which Julius Caesar took back to Rome. The Egyptians figured out a very fine, nice, even calendar. 12 months, 30 days each. Now you end up 5 days short, so they just tacked on an extra 5 day period. There's a fancy name for those, the epigominal days. 5 days at the end of the year. 12 months, 30 days each, 5 days at the end. Nice even calendar. And then the Romans got the messing around with it. Julius Caesar did put on a leap year day. But so that evened it out a little bit more with the sun. But then they started making months greater, longer. So July has 31 days in honor of Julius, and August has 31 days in honor of Augustus, and so on and so forth. So the Romans started messing with this very nice, neat calendar, and that's the calendar we have today. And of course, Pope Gregory in the 16th century added a leap century day, and that evened things up even a little bit more. Now we have the death date for this pharaoh, or the date when he's supposed to have ascended to the sun god. And we have tables where we can take the Egyptian calendar and our Julian Gregorian calendar and make them equal and figure out what the Egyptian date is. And so we know this pharaoh died the equivalent of the middle of March, late March. Now, what difference does that make? Well, what was the event that the Israelites celebrated just before they left Egypt? Passover. When does Passover come? In the spring, March, April. It overlaps March, April. This king dies in March, April. And so he dies at the right time of the year. Now, there's something unusual about his mummy. We happen to have his mummy. And his mummy has been studied by x-rays. In fact, all of the royal mummies have been studied by x-rays. And you can date the approximate age of a person by their x-rays, first by the growth lines in the skull, and then by the growth lines at the end of the long bones. And this king's skeleton dates to age 40 plus or minus 5 years. Now, I told you how in another inscription how long he reigned. 54 years. And he probably was at least a child of 6 years of age when he came to the throne. So he would have been in actual biological years at least 60 when he died. Probably more, let us say 65. But his mummy only dates to age 40. What's the problem? Problem is, we may not have Thutmose III as that mummy. Now think for a moment. If you were an Egyptian search party that was sent out after the Egyptian troops with Pharaoh had gone in pursuit of the Israelites, and you came to the shore of the Red Sea, and there were some bodies that washed up. Exodus 15 tells us the bodies of the Egyptians washed up on the shore. Some of the bodies washed up, and some of the bodies didn't. Well, let's just suppose for a moment that the body of Pharaoh didn't wash up. What would you do as commander of the expedition to retrieve the body of Pharaoh? Well, I don't know what you'd do, but I'd poke another body in there. And so what we may have is a substitute body which was brought back from among the Egyptian soldiers on the shore of the Red Sea, or whichever lake it was, that was buried in with royal honors in place of Thutmose III, whose body was lost at sea. Now you might ask, how do we know that Pharaoh died at the time of the Red Sea events? Exodus 14 and 15. Exodus 14 gives the events in prose, and Exodus 15 gives the events in poetry. It does not specifically say that Pharaoh drowned there. But if you look at Psalm 137, which is one of these historical psalms, it tells about the various events that happened, and it says the Lord cast Pharaoh and his chariots in the sea. So we have the direct implication of Exodus 14 and 15 is that Pharaoh drowned. And the specific statement of a later psalm is that the Israelites knew that Pharaoh had drowned. So we have a Pharaoh who has an unusual mummy that really doesn't fit with his reign and his inscriptions. He dies at the right time of year. And he also dies in approximately the right year. Now, how do we know that? Well, we have to add up biblical years. You can start out with the reign of Solomon, who began to reign about 970. And this date is fairly well fixed because of all the interlocking dates of the kings. Now, when he began to build the temple, 1 Kings 6:1 says, it was 480 years after the Exodus that Solomon began to build the temple. So if Solomon comes to the throne, actually he started to build in the fourth year of his reign. So Solomon came to the throne in 970. And it's 480 years back from that. I'll do the addition for you. You come out to about 1450, plus or minus a couple of years in there. Now what are the dates of the reign of this Pharaoh? 1504, and remember, he reigned for 54 years, to 1450. So the date of the end of the reign of this Pharaoh, according to his inscriptions, fits very well with the date for the biblical Exodus. There was not a Pharaoh on the throne for another 25 years before him, or another 25 years after him. So if you want a Pharaoh who falls right at the Exodus date, here he is, Thutmose III, the empire builder of Egypt. And it's nice that we have his statue since we don't seem to have his body. Here's another view of him. It's in a glass case, and there's a little bit of flash on the glass case, so doesn't show up as well. Well, this is an unusual person. I mentioned her yesterday. Her name is Hatshepsut. Now, Hatshepsut had an interesting career. She started out as a princess. She was the daughter of a pharaoh. Then she was married to a pharaoh. So she went from being a princess to becoming a queen. She was the daughter of Thutmose the First. She was the wife of Thutmose the Second. And she was the stepmother of Thutmose the Third. Now, he apparently was in his minority when his father died. And so she took the throne. You know, she could have run the country as the queen mother, but she decided to put herself on the throne itself as king. And in fact, we have an inscription where she, which is probably false propaganda, about her father having chosen her to be pharaoh. So she's an unusual woman, and you'll notice she looks kind of unusual here. What do you see that's unusual about this woman? She had a beard. That is what is known as a false ceremonial beard. Even the male pharaohs wore one. And so she now, as pharaoh, wears a false ceremonial beard. She is the stepmother of Thutmose the Third, and she runs the government for about 20 years, and finally she dies, she disappears. We don't know what happened to her. Some people think her stepson, who had now come of age, may have done her in. And it's very possible, because quite a number of her monuments throughout Egypt have been chiseled out, have been carved out, as if somebody really wanted to eradicate a knowledge of this woman. And so that is generally attributed to Thutmose the Third. So he takes the throne, continues on the throne, really, because he already was a pharaoh. There were two pharaohs at a time in this case. And she disappears. This is a statue of her, which is located in the Metropolitan Museum in New York City. Her mortuary tomb in Karnak, Luxor area of southern Egypt is the most beautiful architectural building that survives from ancient Egypt. It has a name. It's by the Arabs. It's called Deir el-Bahri. Beautiful, magnificent building, and it probably is more pleasing to the modern eye because it's more like modern architecture than any of the other buildings of ancient Egypt. So here she is, Hatshepsut, first a princess, then a queen, then a king. And the king, who disappears just before the Pharaoh of the Exodus takes the throne. Well, this is a head of a pharaoh from a much later time. This man is mentioned in the Bible. His name is Tirhaka. He's mentioned in 2 Kings 19, and that's the time of Hezekiah. And Hezekiah was under siege by an Assyrian king named Sennacherib, and he called for help from Egypt. And so this is the king who came out to help him, Tirhaka. And you will notice his coloration and the black stone that's used for him. That is because he was of black caste, and he came originally from Nubia, the modern Sudan. So he is a normal black, an ethnic black. And the Nubians, or the Sudanese of that time, marched north and conquered all of Egypt. This is in the 9th, 8th century. And so here's the king then, who gets the word from Hezekiah, come and help me. And so he sets out with his troops and meets the Assyrians. The Assyrians say they defeated him. He goes back to Egypt and doesn't come again to help poor King Hezekiah. But King Hezekiah had other help. He had help from the Lord. And so Isaiah comes to him, Second Kings, the last half of 2 Kings 19, to assure him that the Assyrian king will not set foot in the city of Jerusalem. And indeed, Hezekiah's own inscriptions tell that he says he never claims to have conquered Jerusalem. He says he shut up Hezekiah like a bird in a cage. That's what he says he did. But he never claims to have conquered. So Tirhaka's efforts were not very well rewarded, but Hezekiah survived nonetheless. Now, the starting point for leaving Egypt was a place called Ramses. And this is modern Ramses. I should say the modern site which sits over ancient Ramses. And you can see there's an irrigation ditch, and there's some cotton being grown to the left, and there's a cemetery on towards the far end. And that tells you how much difficulty there is in excavating this place. There is a group from Vienna, Austrian archaeologists who have been working here since 1976, and they have an agreement with the farmers It's kind of like, you remember the old Western song about hugging and chalking? The cowboy who had a fiancée who was very, shall we say, portly, and so he couldn't reach all the way around her to hug her, so he'd hug a little ways, and he'd chalk a mark there, and then he'd hug a little farther, then he'd chalk a mark. Well, that's what the archaeologist has to do here. He will dig a little ways, and then he has an agreement with the farmers in the area that after he has excavated to find out what's down there, he has to fill it in again. So the farmers can continue to use it. They consider it valuable farmland, and they don't want to lose their farmland. So they're not going to have any archaeologists messing up their farms. So the only way they could get an agreement was to hug a little and chalk a little and hug a... So they dig, they find out what's there, they record it photographically, with architectural drawings, with samples, and then they cover it up again. And they move on across the field. Now, it used to be thought that the site of Ramses was located on the coast at a place called Tanis, modern Arabic Tsan el Hajar. But this is now known to be Ramses. This was the city that the Israelites lived nearby. How do we know that? First of all, there is a palace of the King Ramses here from later times. Second, there is a palace from the Hyksos period when the foreign rulers lived here. And it's an extraordinarily interesting palace and buildings because they're not like anything else anywhere else in Egypt. They're like archaeology in Asia. It looks like a transplanted piece of Canaan right in the middle of Egypt. And there are Egyptian texts which say that the palace of Ramses was built on the earlier site of the Hyksos capital. And so you have those two pieces, the palace of Ramses and the Hyksos capital, one on top of another. And this is a clinching identification for the location of Ramses. This is in the delta. And you can see how shallow the excavations are. These excavations go down about a meter. You can see the floor, you can see some blocks along a wall. And you go down a meter and you have gone back 3,500 years. It's very shallow. The excavations are very shallow. And it's not like these tells, a ruin mound like you have in Canaan or Palestine, which are made up of these layer cakes. Here, one period of occupation and slight building on top, and that was it. Nothing more. It was abandoned. This is the floor of a room, and if you can see some of those round circles, those are little granaries that were cut into the floor where they stored the grain that was threshed from nearby fields. And here is a view across the excavation of Ramses. Not very dramatic. In Egypt, you go and look at all these huge monuments and the pyramids and the Sphinx and so forth. And so when you come and look at this, it doesn't look like very much. But it's extraordinarily important in terms of biblical history, because this is the type of the area where the Israelites lived before they left. Here is an illustration of a very typical Canaanite feature and a non-Egyptian feature. Here's a floor of one of the rooms in this city, and there's a jar which was buried right in the floor. And in that jar was found the bones of an infant. And so for infant burials, the Canaanites would use a jar. You know, infant mortality was very high. These are not sacrifices. These are just children who died in infancy. And they would make a jar of suitable size that the infant could be placed in it. And then they would bury it in the floor of their house. And that way the child stayed with them, at least in their memory and in their thoughts and even in a physical presence, in a physical way. They didn't take it out to the cemetery and bury it out there. They buried it in the floor of their house. You can find that all over the land of Canaan, but you can't find it anywhere in Egypt, which shows that Asiatic people lived here. Well, here's a man, a king, who had a transmetatarsal amputation. You may be able to see his toes. This is the toe. These are the toes of a statue of Ramses II, Ramses the Great. And this statue was put up very near his palace. Now the original, you can see the measurement of the size of these feet and toes according to the people who were standing just to the right. And the original statue here probably stood about 30 feet high. About 30 feet high is a statue of Ramses II right adjacent to his palace, helping to further strengthen the identification of Ramses II and the city of Ramses. This is the house where the Austrian archaeologists live when they go there to work. They usually work early in the year. If they've been digging this year, they've probably already finished. And these are some of the objects that have been brought back and put in front of the dig house from the excavations. And here is the cartouche, or the royal circle, with the name of Ramses, the king, inside the circle. The Egyptians put the names of the kings inside these circles. So here's the cartouche of Ramses II, and further identification of the site as Ramses, as the site of one of his palaces. He had other palaces elsewhere in Egypt, but this was his delta capital. Another column and another cartouche of Ramses II, more of the same type of material. And here's another one of his inscriptions on a column, also standing by the Austrian dig house. Well, that's where they left from. Where did they go? The Bible specifically says they did not go by the way of the Philistines. The way of the Philistines was the coastal Mediterranean road. And the reason it was called the way of the Philistines is because it took you right to the country of Philistia, which is the southwestern corner of Israel and Canaan. So where did they go? The next way south out of Egypt is a valley called the Wadi Tumilat. And this is the Wadi Tumilat. And there is a canal here. There has been a canal since 2000 BC. It's a canal that branches off from the Nile River. In ancient times, there were 5 branches to the Nile. In the modern times, there are 2 branches to the Nile. But there was an artificial canal that was cut off from the canal. And it still exists and is in use today. And you can see the shepherds pasture livestock here. So this picture is really supposed to illustrate how the slow-moving Israelites would have taken their livestock with them as they passed out of Egypt. They're traveling east in the Wadi Tumilat. And as they travel east, they come to this place, which can't be seen very well. It has a modern Arabic name of Tel El Mashkuta. Tel El Mashkuta has been excavated by the archaeologist. Here's some of their digging, some of the walls. Not very distinctive, but here's the top plan of the city. And what you notice is there is a wall, a rectangular wall around the outside, and this is a fortress. This is not a city, this is the wall of a fortress. And this fortress was located here for a specific reason. As you go out the Wadi Tumilat, you come to a series of lakes, and those lakes marked the border of Egypt. And so the Egyptians wanted to guard that border. And so this is Checkpoint Charlie, where the nomads, the Bedouins, as they came in and out of Egypt, had to check in here. We actually have the survival of 1 or 2 Egyptian day books, as they are called, from people who worked at border forts like these. And they registered and they said, well, such and such a date, 3 Bedouins came by today. Such and such a date, a group of 20 Bedouins came by. And another 2-3 more days, no Bedouins passed by. And so they kept record, just like an immigration department does today, of who goes in and out of the country. And so here we have the fort right at the border. Now I want you to remember the name of the first place where the Israelites stopped after they left Ramses. And the name of that place in the Bible is Sukkot, or you might call it Succoth. Succoth, Sukkot. That name of the place has a meaning, and the meaning is the place of booths. And what that means is this was a place where there was a campground. And so as you would come in, you would set up your sukkah or your sukkot, if it's plural, and then as you moved on, you would take your sukkot or your tents down as you passed on. So there's a reason for the name of this place, and also, this is a case, I've mentioned several of them to you, where the ancient name has survived in the modern name. The modern Arabic name is Tel El Mashkuta. If you take that last name, Mashkuta, and you knock the M off the front of the word, what you have left is the Hebrew word Sukkot, or Succoth. And so the ancient name of Succoth, or Sukkot, survives in the modern Arabic name of Mashkuta here. The fortress that I just showed you was from later times, 6th century BC, but these structures go back to a much earlier time. They come from the Middle Bronze Age, about the middle of the 2nd millennium BC. And these are more of the top plans of the excavations of the settlement at Tel El Mashkuta. Well, we move on from there, and from here there you go on into the desert. But you don't really come to the desert. What you come to is a series of bodies of water. Now, in the Bible, it says the Israelites crossed, and the Hebrew name is at the Yam Suf. And the question is, what does that word Suf mean? It actually means weeds, the sea of weeds, or maybe seaweed. And so here you have the edge of one of these bodies of water. Now, there's a whole series of these lakes. They were here in ancient times. They have been cut through to make the Suez Canal. In the north, there is Lake Bala. In the middle, right by Tel El Mashkuta, is Lake Timsa. In the south, there are the Great and Little Bitter Lakes. And then finally in the south, there's the Red Sea, the Gulf of Suez. So here's one of these lakes, and here's some Suf along the edge of the lake. This is Lake Timsa, a little larger body of water. The first one was Lake Bala. This is Lake Timsa. And so you can see these lakes are not inconsiderable in size. One of my students at the seminary went down to the state of Missouri, and he was a member of the pastor's league there in the city, and they used to have a pastor's breakfast each Monday morning. And so he happened to be sitting across the table from a rather liberal minister who said, "Well, you know, those lakes where Pharaoh drowned are only 6 inches deep, don't you?" And I had given him all the geographical reasons in class why that wasn't so and where these were and so forth. But he took the direct approach. And he said, "Praise the Lord, he drowned Pharaoh in 6 inches of water." Okay, this is Lake Timsa. So if you went straight east from the fort at Tel El Mashkuta, this is the body of water that you would come to. So this would be one of the candidates for the possible place of the crossing. But the text of Exodus 14 says they arrived, what sounds like at this point, and then they turned. And so the question is, which way did they turn? Well, undoubtedly, they eventually turned south. The question is, which lake did they cross, which body of water? So here's some more Suf along this Lake Timsa. Pretty good-sized body of water. Here's some more Suf. And here's ships of the desert. I always like these pictures, you know. You have just a flat horizon of desert, and there's a ship sailing along there. So this is the modern Suez Canal, and you can see a somewhat rough road that runs parallel to it along in the desert. And that's what the terrain is like. So this modern canal has been cut between these lakes to make the canal. Well, here's a little bit of modern archaeology out in the desert. These are tanks which were left over from the 67 war, I guess. I don't know which war. They had so many. But at any rate, this is an Egyptian tank in the desert, burned out. And here's another one. And so wars have been fought back and forth across this isthmus. Now, the next body of water that you come to going south is called the Great Bitter Lakes. And you may remember an interesting story in the Bible about after they crossed the sea, they came to a body of water, and they tasted the water, and the water was bitter. And so they called it Mara, which is the Hebrew word for bitter. And the interesting thing is, the Great Bitter Lakes and the Little Bitter Lakes carry that name today. Now, why are these lakes bitter? Because of the salt content. And what you see here in the foreground is dried salt pans from the lake, which really is farther over to the right. And so you come to the Great Bitter Lake, and you can see, or maybe you can't see, there's a horizon across this lake, how large it is. So these, even in ancient times, before the canal was cut, these were large bodies of water. So this would be a second candidate for where the crossing might have taken place. First candidate would be Lake Timpson, second candidate would be the Bitter Lakes. And here's another view of the Bitter Lakes. You can see the ocean-going vessels that cross this lake from north to south. And you can see the size and depth of the lake, which really obtained even in ancient times. Well, here's a map of theories of archaeologists as to where the crossing may have taken place. And so basically, you can see the whole cluster, but basically there are three possibilities. You'll notice Lake Timpson in the middle, and you'll see a couple of arrows around that. So that'd be possibility number one. Possibility number two would be the Great and Little Bitter Lakes. Possibility number three would be the Gulf of Suez in the south. And so those are basically the three possibilities of the three bodies of water which would have been the potential crossing places for the Israelites. The net effect, of course, is the same. Egypt loses, Israel wins, and God is demonstrated as being a mighty power and much more mighty than Pharaoh himself. This is a satellite photograph of the Delta of Egypt. And what you see, the greenery there, is the Delta. And you see this little thumb that sticks off to the right. That's the Wadi Tumilat. So the Israelites would have started a little above that, came down to that, marched out, and then crossed. You can hardly see Lake Timsa, but you can see the Great Bitter Lake. And you can see the head of the Gulf of Suez. So having come to the end of that Wadi Tumilat, they turned either across the lake or south and across one of these three bodies of water. You can also see the fertility of the delta as opposed to the desert. And so the old saying that goes back to Herodotus, the Greek historian of the 5th century B.C., Egypt is the gift of the Nile. And here it is. That's what the Nile water does for Egypt. Well, we're out in the Sinai now. And this is a rock carving in Sinai. And I don't know who this is, but I thought it was an interesting illustration because the Israelites fought one battle there. They fought a battle at a place called Rephidim with the Amalekites, or however you wish to call them. So if you wish to use your imagination, you can picture one of these soldiers. You see, he has a shield up and he has a spear on the right, and the fellow on the left has his shield up and he has his spear down a little lower. So the soldiers are doing battle out in Sinai, and the event, whatever event, was recorded on the rocks of Sinai. Well, this is a map, and it looks a little too dark to see very much, at least for me. But here is, what you might call the traditional route of the Exodus. The crossing, in this case, is at the Gulf of Suez, and as they march south, they march along the coast. And this is of interest because there are two lists of the geographical places where they stopped. And in the list, there is a reference to coming back to the sea. So they traveled for a time inland, then they came back to the sea, and then they turned into the wilderness of Sinai. The northern part is the wilderness of Sin, and the lower part is the wilderness of Sinai. And those are biblical names, and those are modern Arabic geographical names. This is another satellite photograph. I'm sorry it's so dark, because it's really a beautiful illustration of the geology of Sinai. What is Sinai like? The light part in the upper half is the northern half of Sinai, and you'll see it's yellow. And it's yellow because it's limestone. Limestone is very porous. It rains on limestone, the water soaks through the limestone. No water there. In the south, you see a big, dark, triangular block. Those are the granite mountains of South Sinai that were pushed up probably at the time of the flood. These granite mountains go up to 7,000, 8,000, and 9,000 feet. Now, granite is a very hard rock, And so when the rains come, and there isn't an awful lot of rain here, the rain runs off these mountains and collects at the base of these mountains. So the paradox of Sinai is the fastest way across is the wrong way because there's no water. The right way around is to take the long way around because you get water everywhere the rivulets come out to the coast from these granite mountains. And so the safest way to cross Sinai is the way the Israelites did it, to follow from one wadi to the next wadi to the next wadi, because there you have water. And so we'll look at, this is a crossing, possible crossing place at the Gulf of Suez. You'll notice a little place called Ayin Musa, or the Moses Well. That is a traditional Arab designation. But obviously, this looked like it had something to do with Moses. And so they put that name there. And there is a place in the Bible which says it has 10 pools or 12 pools and 70 palms. And that's what you find at Ayin Musa. And so here's a drawing from 1905. You'll see the pools and then the palms. Here's a later photograph. There is this whole series of pools and there are palms. This area is used today for truck farming. So they grow vegetables here and they truck the vegetables from this place on into Cairo. So here is a road map of ancient Sinai. And you can see that in the center there's not too much there. But if you follow along the coast, you can follow a route that runs around the coast. And this particular man who drew up this map thought that the Exodus took place where the dotted line goes. But that doesn't fit very well with the biblical description. Here are some more of these trees. Can't be seen very well. A little dark, but this is one of these little rivers that exits Sinai along the coast. And the fact that it grows trees shows you there's water there. And this is another one, also very dark. This one's a little lighter. You can see the dark patch in the middle. That's where the little seasonal river runs. So there are water supplies in Sinai, but you have to know where to look for them. And here's some more of these plants that grow along these water sources. So as you go along the coast, you go from one water source to another water source to another water source, and it makes a very convenient mode of travel. A rather long and indirect mode of travel, but a very safe road of travel because you have water. Even following this route, you remember the story that occurred twice, that they ran out of water completely, and Moses spoke to the rock, and then he struck the rock so that they could obtain water. Here's some date palms, and some brush. Here's broom trees, rather unusual things that grow in these little valleys, little rivulets. And here is an archaeological map of Sinai. This is where the archaeologists have found the locations of settlements of people. And you'll notice the vast expanse where there isn't anything. You notice one little line of sites that happens to be in a place called the Wadi Sudr. But you'll notice the main collection of archaeological sites is in the south. Not in the north, but in the south. And so in that south, that's the traditional area of Sinai and the area where the most occupation was in ancient times. And this is not Mount Sinai, but this is what the granite mountains of southern Sinai look like. Very rugged peaks, irregular valleys sweeping between them. And so some have the theory that Moses and the Israelites, as they fled from the Egyptians, went all the way across the Sinai Peninsula and crossed the Gulf of Aqaba on the other side. If you look at these valleys and you look at the rugged terrain that you'd have to pass through, and then think about the slow-moving Israelites with not only women and children on foot, but also livestock, the distances that would be required from that really seem to me to exceed what the Israelites could have achieved. And then you come to a place which has this very prominent peak. And this very prominent peak has a name. It's Ras Safsaf. But in the back of this, there is a mountain which has been identified since the 4th century A.D. A.D., not B.C. 4th century A.D. as Jebel Musa, the mountain of Moses. And so this is a location of Christian tradition We can't be 100% firm or fixed about that, but at least it illustrates the type of terrain to which the Israelites would have come. And you'll notice the camels are roving freely. They belong to somebody. They belong to Bedouins in the area. So here is the map of this area along the coast as you go in to see where the traditional Mount Sinai is. Everything above the dark line, it says the Atih Plateau. That's all limestone north of there. No water. But down here is granite and runoff and water and rivers. Now, you might be able to read a little place near the point in the middle, Serabit. Serabit. I want to look at that first because that's where the Egyptians had their mines. And here's the map of the mines. And you can see the list of the different pharaohs that sent out mining expeditions. And the letters up above correspond to the different mines that were located in different places. They were excavating turquoise. Turquoise that went on jewelry, like we showed you earlier in the slides. And so this is the area of the mines. And about the middle, towards the top, is the area of the temple. And so the Egyptians built a temple here. The temple was to the goddess Hathor. The goddess Hathor, who was thought to be the patron goddess of Sinai. Now this temple took 800 years to build. It started in the caves at the top. And each king that sent out another expedition, they would build more on this temple. And little by little, century by century, they added more onto it. So the cave at the top dates to its use as a shrine for the god dates to about 2000 BC. The lowest rung of the temple in this long extension is about 1200 BC. So 1200 BC at the end, 2000 BC at the top. It took 800 years of miners going out and adding onto this temple. And this is the goddess that they worshiped there that was supposed to protect them in the mines and in their expedition in and out. Here's a model of this temple. I'm sorry it's so dark, but you might be able to see these pillars. The pillars mark the trail up to the top where they did the worshiping. And the pillars mark the trail that runs alongside of the length of the temple. And here's another view of that model. And so all of this was cut right out of the middle of the Sinai Desert. And this is what it looks like today. The pillars, and you can see some of them fallen, some of them still standing. You can see some of the Egyptian carvings on them. Now, I'm sorry this one doesn't show up, because this is Hathor herself. And can any of you see what her ears look like? Anybody right in the middle? Again, you get a good... Too dark, isn't it, huh? Well, she has the face of a woman, the hair of a woman, and the ears of a cow. This is the god, goddess, I should call her, who is the patron goddess of Sinai. She is sometimes represented in human form like this. She is sometimes represented as a cow. Now, what connection does that have with the biblical story? You may remember that when Moses was up in the mount, the people at the foot of the mountain appealed to Aaron and had him make a golden calf. Calves go with cows. And here is the cow. And the calf is her offspring, and there is a theological connection to the place where the Israelites were, and they say, these are your gods who brought you out of the land of Egypt. Now, why would that god, that pagan god, bring them out of the land of Egypt? Because the pagan god which they worshipped in this way was the patron goddess of Sinai. And so the calf has connections to the cow, which has connections to the goddess Hathor, who is the patron goddess of Sinai. So there's a pagan theological reason why they happen to make the form of that statue in the form of a calf rather than in the form of a horse or a donkey or what have you. And so here's the Egyptian. Here she is again. And you can see her a little better now. Her eyes, nose, mouth, and her ears, which are the ears of a cow, showing the bovine characteristic of the goddess Hathor. Well, there is writing out in Sinai. In fact, there is some of the earliest writing of mankind in an alphabet. Now, in Egypt, they wrote in hieroglyphs. In Babylon, they wrote with cuneiform writing. But in Canaan, they wrote with an alphabet. And that has the distinct advantage. If you learned to write cuneiform, you had to learn 625 signs. If you learned to write hieroglyphs, you had to learn 2,000 signs. If you learned to write with an alphabet, you had to learn 22 letters. And here they are. The column on the left, well, the far left with my handwriting is the Hebrew alphabet today. But the next column over, after the phonetic equivalents, the next column over, which shows you those forms of the letters, these are the early development form of the letters. And as they went through an evolution through time, and in fact as they go to the right of this screen, they develop more and more and more until we get to our alphabet today. What you write with your alphabet, is derived from this. This is the original ancestor of the alphabet. It was invented probably by Canaanite miners working for the Egyptians in the 16th or 15th centuries BC. Now, I got started on a story Monday that I didn't get to finish, so this gives me an opportunity to finish it. There was a critic of the Bible in the last century. His name was Julius Wellhausen. He said Moses could not have written the Pentateuch because there was no alphabetic writing in his time. Well, here it is. These inscriptions were the first one was discovered in 1867, but a group of them were discovered in 1905. And it wasn't until about 1912 that the first decipherment of the first few letters of this alphabet were developed. And so you can see it's very, very different from our alphabet. You have to trace back through a series of these forms to get back to this earliest form. Let me just take you one example that I mentioned already at the top. Let's take the top two letters. The top one in the third column on the left is the head of an ox. And the head of an ox, it has the Semitic name Alpum. Alpum. And so they took the A sound and made the ox head stand for it. And if you think about this ox head and what those horns eventually develop, if you rotate it and modify it a little bit, you get the letter A. You turn it around, upside down, you have the two horns of the ox. The letter B comes from the house, the word beit or baith. And so what happened to this letter is it folded in to make the two loops of the B, and then it rotated, and then you have our B. So you start from this box, and it folds in, and so forth, all the way down through the rest of these letters. And here's what these inscriptions look like. These are mining inscriptions. They are found in the mines. The one down at the lower left is found right at the mouth of the mine. And so these miners in the 16th and 15th centuries BC were writing with this alphabet. Some of these have been translated. They are very difficult to translate. And it seems to me that some of these, at least one of them, may have been done by the Israelites. Now, that's very disputed, of course, because these are very difficult to read. And so it's very difficult to read at a positive, definitive translation. But at least, at the very least, these show that Wellhausen's criticism that Moses couldn't have written because he didn't have an alphabet to write with are definitely overthrown by the archaeological evidence of the writing that occurs in Sinai at his time. These people were writing with this script when Moses went out and lived here for 40 years. So he had ready and ample opportunity to acquire this kind of writing skill. Growing up at the Egyptian court, he undoubtedly wrote hieroglyphs. He probably learned cuneiform because the Egyptian Foreign Office wrote in cuneiform to the kings in the East. So he already knew two writing forms, and here a third one comes along. He learns how the Canaanite miners out there write. He himself adopts this alphabetic writing, And if you wanted to guess, what the script of the original form of the Ten Commandments that was written in the 15th century B.C., this would be about as close as you could get to the form of those letters. Very different from the Hebrew that is printed and written today. Very different, but it's different because it has gone through 1,500 years of evolution down to the time of Jesus and more onto the printed Hebrew Bibles today. So there's writing in Sinai, and who knows, maybe some of it comes from Israelites. And so here's a table of the alphabet as to how it developed. And so you have the letters from top to bottom, from Aleph to Tau. You can see the cross of the Tau at the bottom. And the inscriptions that document these are listed across the top as you go from the 15th century B.C. down to about the 9th century B.C. as the alphabet develops further. And here's one of those inscriptions. Here's the one that I think may have come from Israelites. I'll give you my own personal beautiful little drawing of it. It reminds me of a story of one of my professors who said he tried to teach hieroglyphs to his wife, but he didn't have an artistic hand and she couldn't make the hieroglyph signs really pretty, and so she couldn't be an Egyptologist. So, but at any rate, this inscription is located, it's all off by itself. It's 20 miles west of the mines. And that says to me that this inscription comes from some other unusual circumstance rather than minor. There are no mines around this inscription. It's just cut up on the hillside, very near an Egyptian inscription. Well, when you get to the traditional Mount Sinai, here's what you have to do. You have to climb. Now, fortunately, the Israelis have cut a trail up the back of Mount Sinai to up to Jabal Musa. But there is a straight way up, and then there's the kind of more easy trail up the back. And so here's some people going up the straight way, or actually coming down the straight way. A nice way to do it is to go up the easy way and come back the hard way. This is the St. Catherine's Monastery. And you can see the slope, or the steep slope of the mountain up to the right. That's the side of Mount Sinai, Mount Rosh Safsa. And this monastery was the site of a very famous Bible discovery, one of the three great early Bibles. The Codex Sinaiticus was found here in the year 1844. A man named Tischendorf who made his life's career of looking for Bible manuscripts to confirm the text of the Bible. And he came here in 1844, and he found the leaves of this Bible, according to his story, in a trash basket. So his story is he rescued it. Of course, the monks who continue to live there today say he stole it. And so it eventually went to the head of the Eastern Orthodox Church. It then went from him to the Tsar of Russia. The King of England bought it and placed it in the British Museum. So if you want to see the Codex Sinaiticus, which was found in 1844 here at this monastery, it's in the British Museum today. You're just sitting in a glass cabinet as you walk through the halls, you just see, oh, there it is. And it's a fabulous biblical treasure. 4th century A.D. Codex, early form of the Bible. Well, here's the mountain. Pretty impressive peak, I would say. And the interesting thing about it is there is a huge plain out in front of it. There may be other places in Sinai where there's a plain that large, but not very many places. In fact, the Israeli Air Force used it at one time for an airport. And so this is Rosh Safsa. Now, Siegfried Horn, who taught archaeology at Andrews University, was of the theory that this was probably the place, and Jebel Musa in the back did not serve very well. But if Moses wanted to look down on the camp, and if the camp people in the camp could see Moses or could see the manifestations of God over the mountain, it would have taken place on this forward peak. And so this is a better candidate for the traditional Mount Sinai, the Mount Sinai of the Bible. This may not be it. But if it isn't it, it gives you a very good idea of what the Mount Sinai in the Sinai Peninsula in these high granite mountains of southern Sinai was like. So if it's not the place, then it's very much like the place. And so this would be the site of the giving of the law. And that takes us to the conclusion of our tour of Sinai, our way out of Egypt. And I guess I should give you a little time for questions. Anybody have any? Yes. Mm-hmm. There is no specific mention outside the Bible of Joseph. But recent excavations at Tel El Daba, that's the name of the place that I gave you, Ramses, have found something very extraordinary and unusual. They have found a tomb which comes from about 1800 BC, about the time of Joseph. And this tomb has in it, the tomb is in two sections. There's a back compartment, and then there's the forward burial chamber. In the back compartment, there was found the head of a statue. It clearly is the head of an Asiatic. It's not the head of an Egyptian. In front of that, and it's rather striking to find the head of a statue placed right in a tomb. Right in front of that, there is found a tomb. The tomb had been originally sealed. It was opened up, and the skeleton that was in that tomb is now missing, for whatever reason. Now, it would appear that the head of the statue is the head of an important Egyptian official. He is a Semite. He was buried here. His bones were removed at some time later. And his tomb is the largest, most important tomb in that entire area of that cemetery at Ramses. Now, that doesn't prove it's Joseph. But it might be Joseph. And if it's not Joseph, it illustrates exactly what happened to Joseph. That he, as an Asiatic who came to Egypt, rose to a very prominent position like this governor who was buried here. So that's about as close as we can get to Joseph at the present time. Yes. Very good question. The question is Hatshepsut considered the princess who rescued baby Moses? We can't say for sure, but she sure fits at the right time. Now, the Bible says that Moses was 80 years old when he left Egypt. Aaron was 83. He was born 3 years old. He was 3 years older than Moses. If you measure from the Exodus date of 1450, and you measure back 80 years, that takes you to about 1530, and that takes you to the time when Hatshepsut was a princess, before she was married and became a queen. So she sure fits very well, and this is a woman who had a lot of power at court, even before she became a female king. So I don't know of any direct way to prove that, but she's certainly the best candidate that we know of. Yes. Yes. Okay, the question is, are the same roads that were used in ancient times or century after century still used today? And the answer is yes. In fact, what happens commonly is the people who have made the donkey paths or whatever you want to call it for transit have established such a marker that when the modern people come along, they pave that. And so the Egyptians, the Israelis and the Egyptians who have had, you know, the Sinai has changed hands back and forth, and both the Israelis and the Egyptians have done some paving of roads, and in general, they have followed the course of the ancient roads. That's correct. Way in the back.
Just a two-fold question. One is, in the book of Galatians, it says the Sinai of Arabia is not the part of it. Someone told me a video about a month ago, I think it's by Australia. Gray,
yeah, Jonathan Gray.
That they have found Sinai in
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, yes. Jonathan Gray is really following after the work of Ron Wyatt, whom we've mentioned a couple times here. Ron Wyatt has the theory that the Mount Sinai was over in Saudi Arabia. In fact, he's picked out a mountain. It's called Jebel El-Lawz. It's about 50-60 miles from the coast of the Gulf of Aqaba, going east. The area is off limits at the present time. The Saudi Arabian government does not welcome much archaeological exploration, and in particular, they don't welcome archaeological exploration that might potentially have biblical implications. So the area is closed at the present time, but there was an oil man working for Aramco who got in there to videograph this place for about 8 hours worth of video film. I've seen a digest of about half an hour of it. There are some interesting carvings. There are carvings of cows on the rocks. That's about the only thing that I saw of archaeological significance. Ron Wyatt would like to say that this is related to the golden calf. I don't know of any direct evidence or proof for that. We don't know, I think the site is archaeologically interesting. I suspect that it probably was a Midianite settlement. We haven't dated anything there yet. Now Ron feels that he sees all kinds of things that are related in the Bible. I have not been able to see those in looking at the boiled down version of the video. Now about the chariot wheels, I have seen one photograph. Someone tells me there's more, but the one photograph I have seen of a so-called chariot wheel, and I wrote to Ron about it and said, look, this chariot wheel has thick rims. If you look at the tomb paintings and carvings of the 18th dynasty, the chariots that are depicted there have thin rims. The thick rims come from Assyrian chariots of the 8th and 9th centuries B.C. So now I can't speak for the other photographs that others have seen, but I have seen that one. And I have pointed this out to him. He has done some scuba diving. This is found in the Gulf of Aqaba between the Sinai Peninsula and to the east. So to me, the evidence does not yet fit very well. And I think the distances involved, the biblical names involved, and the writing that is present in the West but is not present in the East are probably factors that, to me, seem to favor the traditional Mount Sinai. Yes, somewhere back here. Look, a young man? You mean what time of the year or what year? What year? I would say, according to the biblical dates, about 1450 B.C. 1450 to 1445 B.C., somewhere along in that range. Okay, here?
Back in the time of Jericho, was it typical that they buried dead in battle when they defeated the flesh?
It depended on which way the battle went. For example, there are some cases. Cyrus himself is an example of this, and the King Sargon was another example of this. Sometimes even the body of the king was lost on the battlefield. In other words, the enemy won the battle, and the Assyrian troops, or the Persian troops later, were not able to even reclaim the body of the king. Now, this was considered a national disgrace when the body of the king was not retrieved and taken home to be buried. And so, as I say, it kind of depends on who won the battle. Now, we have an example in Israel at the city of Lachish, or Lachish, where there is a tomb of about 1,500 bodies that were just dumped in a pile in a cave. It looks like this is either the Assyrians, after they had conquered that city, dumped the Israelite bodies there, or the Assyrians left the bodies and the Israelites, when they came back to clean up, put all the bodies in a common grave. So you do have those kinds of features. Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm. Why wouldn't the accident occur in between the lakes instead of getting...
Well, Yeah, those land bridges are not all that passable. They're swampy too, and they were more swampy in ancient times than they are today. So they were not very easily passable places either. But part of the reason, of course, is the theology of Exodus 14. You know, they could have gotten out of Egypt before Pharaoh got there. But the Lord really says, turn around and wait here and let Pharaoh catch up, because I'm going to get glory over Pharaoh. I mean, this is a contest between gods, and we're going to show who's the false god and who's the true god. Yeah. Another question here. Oh yes, I'm sure that there are tombs, many, many, many tombs, which have not been found. I'll finish with a story. It's 3:30, I ought to let you go. The story is about W.F. Albright. He grew up as the son of a Methodist minister in the country of Chile. As a Methodist, living in a Catholic society, he was a kind of persecuted or, you know, rejected by the boys of his time, so he took refuge in his father's library. And so he became a very, very studious boy and read everything in his father's library. And so it whetted his ambition to become an archaeologist. But he was worried. He was worried that maybe all of the sites in the Middle East were going to be dug up before he ever got there. Now, Professor Albright has lived to the ripe old age of 84, and died 25 years ago, and we've still barely scratched the surface of the Middle East. Some of these major cities like Hazor or Hatzor, it would take 100 years to fully excavate this city of 140 acres. Now, the archaeologist only takes a sample of what's there. So that's the nice thing about archaeology. There's always something more to find. You never know what's going to show up in the next shovelful. Well, thank you for your attention. You've been a very attentive audience. I've appreciated having you, and I pray that you'll have a very blessed Sabbath as you go into this final victorious Sabbath weekend of the final weekend of camp meeting. God bless you all.
You have been listening to another special American Cassette Ministries presentation. This recording has been digitally reprocessed from the original audio cassette in order to make this CD available. The audio quality was improved as much as possible. International copyright American Cassette Ministries, all rights reserved. To order CDs or audio cassettes of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 1-800-233-4450. International calls, please dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.americancassette.org. There you will discover the largest selection of genuine Adventist preaching available. American Cassette Ministries is not a one-man band. It's an orchestra of outstanding speakers who are all on the same theological page. You can trust ACM. There's no compromise here. If American Cassette Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? Our email address is info@americancassette.org. We'll share it with the speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and financial support are important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He's coming soon.